very much, Greg. I do want to add, first of all, my thanks to the Onassis Foundation, to its president, Dr. Anthony Papadimitriou, and to the academic organizers, Dr. Niki Tsironi and Dr. George Babinotis. Σας ευχαριστούμε για όλα. As with so many other notions in the history of ideas, these owe their fundamental formulation to the work of ancient Greeks, not just to a few high-profile thinkers, but to generations of anonymous men and women who practiced verbal and material crafts, from the humble arts of cloth weaving to the intricate skills of rhetoric and poetry. Of course, to call craft humble and poetry intricate is to prejudice the issue with a distorted modern perspective. We need to work harder to understand how the concepts of logos and techne are related in the ancient Greek world, and how that relationship played a major role in subsequent history. It has, among other things, shaped the way in which we understand performance and aesthetics. Some important features in the early development of this intellectual matrix form the core of my paper, and I'm happy to say that my paper picks up on a thread from Gregory Nagy's paper, both of these in their full versions online, in which he talks about the ever-renewed peplos of the Panathenaia. And I think if we can pinpoint one theme for our entire panel today, it's that sense of eternal renewal and rejuvenation, which is so prominent in the Greek tradition, ancient, medieval, and modern. I'm sure that you'll see in every one of these presentations that theme, rejuvenation, or renaissance, or anagenesi, coming up again and again. In the paper online, I examine two specific examples in order to highlight the close relationship that binds together craft, art, ritual, and performance, verbal as well as other, in the ancient Greek imagination. What in turn unites the mythopoetic examples is the presence of the contest, or the agon, and the crucial notion arising from that quintessential Greek idea of contest, the crucial notion of crisis or krisis, which we can translate, I think, judgment under pressure. Kind of like Hemingway's Grace Under Pressure, krisis is judgment under pressure. As an indication of their enduring importance, as well as the high stakes that are involved in these two concepts, we should notice the semantic shading of their English derivatives, agony for agon, and crisis from krisis. It seems, in other words, that making an impact through logos and techne is potentially fraught with dangers, rendering the outcomes, expressions, and arts of all types all the more precious. And in this connection, I want to thank Ioanna Papadopoulou, who has already, thanks to the e-journal, annotated my paper. And Ioanna points out that in Parmenides, a philosophical poem on nature, the theme of krisis underlies the remaining context, especially fragment 8. So krisis is important for Parmenides' view of the whole universe. I want to stress that this attitude toward verbal and material craft involving judgment and contest arising from a specific context of rituals and festivals puts its mark on the classical tradition in literature and in art for all subsequent Western culture. Now, as a philologist, my instinct is to delve into the earliest texts and pay attention to nuances of diction regarding logos and techne. This is not the place for the full-scale book-length analysis, but let me observe that the most striking result of such investigations, when you carry them out, is that in the Greek tradition, material and verbal skills, those which we can tentatively assign respectively to techne and to logos, are not in a relationship of subordination. It's not that one is low and the other is higher. Weaving, carpentry, metalworking, painting, sculpture, embroidery, all of these technai, plural of techni, are by no means humble. They are quite literally divine. If you follow the passages in which these are mentioned in our earliest sources, and even back to our Mycenaean sources in the Linear B tablets of the 13th century BC. This is a good point at which to remind ourselves that the other term naming our session, logos, is equally rich and broad when it comes to ancient usage. Sometimes it's interpreted as an overarching concept that covers the range represented by Latin with its pair of terms, ratio and oratio. So logos, like ratio, is mental skill, reason, intelligence, even cunning intelligence. And the product of that skill is more like oratio, an account, verbal art. Some of these verbal arts we encountered in this morning's session on stories and histories, which is really all about logoi. In the latter sense, as it becomes clear, logos will tend to overlap with techne rather than be the polar opposite. Because the making of a well-shaped, appropriate, reasonable speech is as much a craft or an art as is the weaving of cloth or the fashioning of useful objects in wood. It's emblematic of this association that the art or craft of poetry is presented within Greek poetry metaphorically in terms of weaving and carpentry. And in modern Greek, the word for literature, logotechnia, literally word craft, I think perfectly encapsulates a point of view that you can already detect in our Greek text from 2.5 millennia earlier. Well, what I try to show in the longer online paper, which I won't try to squeeze into these 10 minutes, is how these concepts work themselves out in two case studies. It so happens that the case studies both derive from the archaic hymn to Apollo, about which Professor Nagy has already spoken. The hymn to Apollo as we have it is a long poem in hexameters attributed to Homer, composed perhaps between 700 and 500 BCE. This afternoon, I only want to sketch out the basic conclusion of my first case study, and I'll just project the second. The first case study is called Poseidon's Crash Test. In the hymn to Apollo, there's a mysterious episode. Apollo goes on a journey up to his new shrine at Delphi. In fact, he hasn't yet established the shrine. He's about to. In his progress toward Parnassos, the young god Apollo stops at a place called Onkestos, about 25 kilometers northwest of Thebes in Boeotia. A grove of Poseidon seems to have occupied a narrow pass there, as the archaeologists now are finding there are remains of a temple. It's a place called Steni nowadays, and the poet of the hymn provides a brief and intriguing digression about this place, this pass. He addresses Apollo and says, "You reached Poseidon's glorious grove on Onkestos, where the newly tamed colt takes a breather, a horse, a colt, it takes breath, burdened as it is pulling the beautiful chariot. And on the ground goes the driver, even a good one, having leapt from the chariot. Meanwhile, the horses, casting off his lordship, the drivers, rattle the empty vehicle, and if the chariot breaks in the wooded grove, they take care of the horses, but they leave the chariot tilted up. For thus, first of all, was the sacred rite. And they pray to the Lord, but the God's dispensation after that guards the chariot." What's going on in this ritual? There have been any number of attempts to interpret it. This ritual reaffirms and celebrates surely the commanding role of Poseidon when it comes to horses and horsemanship. Poseidon, under his cult title of Hippios, the one who deals with horses. But in the ritual of Poseidon, as you see it at this small place in Boeotia, Onkestos, what's being commemorated is actually a failure, a chariot crash. The ritual calls for a human to surrender control Even one who is a good driver, we're told, must leave his comfort zone, his place of special power and confidence. And you could easily spin this into a New Age religious metaphor about how we all have to do that, etc. I don't think that's what's going on in the ancient world. In the ancient ritual, the charioteer goes on the ground, and so he takes on the role of his opposite in terms of fighting ability. He becomes like a foot soldier. And meanwhile, his horses and his chariot continue driving without him. It's important that the driver is said to leap out of the chariot in what must itself have been a conspicuous display of courage and skill, as well as a useful maneuver for battle. So it's a good thing to know how to do. To strike another Californian note, not so New Age, I would compare the similar, highly illegal display of manhood, which is known in some neighborhoods of Oakland, as ghost riding. And in ghost riding, and I'd be happy to later in discussion pop up on the screen one of the thousands of YouTube videos that record ghost riding. I'm not sure how to translate ghost riding into Greek either. Idolo something. In ghost riding, you get souped up street racing cars instead of horse-drawn chariots, and the driver starts the car and then jumps out and often gets on the roof or dances alongside the car as it drives itself. As I say, it's illegal in most parts of California. In the ritual in Onkestos, it's as if the horses are aggressively trying to lose the last vestige of human culture that's been attached to them. The artifice of humans is here abandoned almost like an experiment or a gamble or an odd kind of horse race. And the experiment, like the athletic event of leaping from a moving chariot, is in itself very modern sounding. It is, in brief, the ultimate crash test, although without crash test dummies. The driverless car, the chariot, is subjected to all of the unpredictable shocks and bumps that a new Volvo undergoes in its Swedish torture chamber. Now, the poem, the Hymn to Apollo, continues, "If the chariot breaks in the wooded grove, on the one hand they take care of the horses, but on the other hand they leave it, the chariot, having tilted it up. For this was the holy rite, and they pray to the Lord, and then the portion or lot of the god, the Moira of the god, guards that chariot." From the point of view of human culture, in other words, the chariot loses its usefulness and is left behind. But from the god's point of view, it's an acquisition in the form of a dedication. So it's the logic of sacrifice, which works in the same way. But what exactly does it mean to dedicate a chariot, an unsuccessful vehicle, to Poseidon? We usually think of dedications as indicative of success. For example, the small silver votive plaques, to take a diachronic moment, these plaques that one finds clustered around almost every icon in a Greek Orthodox church, the plaques are meant to show thanks to God or the Virgin and the saints. Exactly that kind of dedicatory habit was ubiquitous in ancient Greece, but the broken chariot is not like that. Instead, it commemorates Poseidon's power in contrast to human weakness. At the same time as the failure, in this case the driverless car, is displayed, perhaps they recalled, maybe in oral traditions, perhaps in written traditions, the heroic leap of the driver. In the Onkestos ritual, as we get it in the Hymn to Apollo, Poseidon is granted the ultimate visible recognition that he has the superior skills when it comes to chariot control, through the dedication of uncontrolled, broken human vehicles. The vehicles don't really signify an opposition of God versus heroic driver. It doesn't seem to be that Poseidon Hippias, the master, is showing up the would-be masters of his art. I think the Hymn to Apollo suggests a different scenario with which I'll conclude, and this involves a four-way, multifaceted krisis, testing or judgment under pressure. So if the crash test of the ritual does not really invoke successful driving, because there is no driver, what exactly is being tested, I ask myself? And my answer is techne, or craft. Put simply, on display when your chariot enters the wooded grove of the god, to crash or to survive intact is the skill of whatever joiner or carpenter who puts together wood made the chariot. Now the word for joiner, this kind of carpenter, in ancient Greek is tekton, which shares its root with techne. And it's not impossible that the driver himself was the same as the joiner, the tekton, although he need not have been. It's interesting that in Homeric epic, people who drive chariots also seem to make their own chariot parts, like wheels. It's as if you race your own race car, but you also are a good maker of cars. Despite the somewhat unusual nature of this ritual, we must recognize in it a format that characterized Greek art and craft for centuries, the performance of the highly crafted chariot. And I'm using that exactly in our sense of the performance of your Audi or your Mercedes. The performance is done in four different facets. It's in a religious setting. Number two, it involves an explicit or implicit contrast and contest with other performers. Here, all of the other chariots that have been driven through the grove, all of the other driver leapers, all of the other carpenters. Number three, this is done for the ultimate purpose of glorifying a divinity. And number four, in the process, what is provided are implicit or explicit criteria whereby a person can judge further performance. So that's the whole package that you see in a kernel form in Onkestos. And just one other important philological note, criterion, that which enables the krisis or the crisis, is established by the crisis. So we get our criteria for performance or for aesthetic judgment from this kind of test scenario, the crash test. This four-part definition, based on an archaic poetic description of an obscure ritual in Boeotia, can easily apply to the best-known aesthetic events from classical Athens, right here. The musical, dramatic, rhapsodic contest of the Panathenaia and the Dionysia, the soil from which our texts of Homer, Sophocles, Aristophanes, and hundreds of other poets grew, recitations of epic, the playing of the pipe or the aulos, the playing of the concert lyre, the kithara, singing to these instruments, staging of tragedy, comedy, satyr play, dithyramb, all of that fits into the notion of a craft contest, a much bigger form than the Onkestos ritual, but using exactly the same four facets. We even hear in antiquity of art contests in painting, for example, and the same format would apply to them. It may not be irrelevant given the context that the very medium of the Homeric hymn is known to be a contest performance medium. The hymn to Apollo, which preserves this Onkestos passage, may itself have been the result of a contest in rhapsodic hymn composition in performance. And when we think of Socrates composing a hymn to Apollo, yet another thread is that Socrates is the latest competitor in what has been a centuries-long tradition of composing hymns to Apollo, or recomposing them. At the very least, as I've argued elsewhere, it can be interpreted, the hymn to Apollo, as itself representing a contest between Homer and Hesiod in a stylized form. And there are ancient traditions about the life of Homer that have him competing at Delos, precisely in composing a hymn to Apollo. The second case study in my paper will take up the whole issue of the meaning of performance on the kithara by Apollo, in contrast to Apollo's performance on the lyre, which is a much different instrument, much smaller, much softer sounding. Some ancient traditions competing with the major one wanted Apollo not to play the big concert lyre, the kithara, but to play the little lyre associated with drinking parties. But that's another story. You can read it online. Once again, it emerges that there's a contest and ritual framework to archaic Greek performance, and along with local Athenian social conditions, that determines the dominant aesthetic of a particular practice. So here's my conclusion. the study of the criteria or the criteria for competition and performance leads us to really basic questions about logos and techne. What is beautiful and who decides? Is what is beautiful that which flatters, that which persuades, that which fascinates, that which requires heroic exertions of mind and body like leaping from a chariot, or that which simply endures, or some combination? And does the beautiful endure because it is so well crafted, like a sturdy chariot hurried on by the horses of time? Are we who aim for the beautiful dedicated to some divinity, if not expressly, then at heart? Does Hellenic civilization, in its many phases, endure because of its beauties tested over time, subjected to contestation and reinvention, to the kenotomia, the innovation, that the very enkenia of this Athens dialogue and beautiful center celebrates and embodies? Thank you.